If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello.
Hello.
So have you heard from him yet?
Who?
Simon Cowell, about your brilliant game show format, Crisp Word Association.
No, it's funny. The phone hasn't rung.
Strange that, isn't it?
No, I know.
I thought you would be fighting off offers from the TV companies.
No, I think not. I think it's just our own little homemade sort of game show.
Your brain is so fertile at the moment, what with that and
make your own sandwiches. I know.
You're going through a real purple patch.
I would say the sort of war on goop has maybe gone better than Crisp Word Association. Did you like my hot cross buns?
Yeah, Ed brought hot cross buns today, which I was...
Which you burnt in the toaster.
I did, yeah.
Not disastrously.
I wouldn't have had you down as a hot cross bun guy.
Why not?
I don't know.
Because I'm so svelte.
You are quite svelte, but I largely attribute to that to you just being tall.
Actually, talking of svelte, I went to Doncaster Rovers, our local football club in Doncaster. And
did you have a tryout with them?
I think, no, they didn't want me. But they've got this fitness scheme for local people, and I met one guy who's lost 7 stone in a year.
Did he do the thing with his trousers where he...
No, he didn't do the thing with his trousers.
Where people who've lost a lot of weight, they wear their old trousers.
He wasn't wearing his old trousers, no.
Shame.
But, he lost 7 stone. I didn't even see the before and after pictures. Mm. But anyway, it's quite good because they like work in the local community. You know, people who are Doncaster Rovers fans come along and take part in this exercise. And he was saying what a difference it made to his diet. They were all saying it, actually. It's great. It's great. Great scheme.
And was there a local photographer there? Did you do some
keepy-uppies? I don't think I could do keepy-uppies to save my life.
Really. I think we'd all enjoy photos of you trying, though.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, I'm going to get into some exercise as soon as I've got my injuries sorted out.
What are your injuries?
I put my back out lifting my son up the other day, so I've been to a physiotherapist twice now.
Do you want me to go and give you a massage?
Why not? It's particularly bad around my left shoulder, but oh, that feels good. Oh, Ed, this is your gift in life. Those big, strong hands. Oof. Do I feel tense to you?
You do feel quite tense.
There we go.
Is that need to do you any good?
Yeah, it really is. Yeah. I do think there's a second chapter for you in physiotherapy.
Is that better?
Yeah, you've got the gift. Next week, I'm going to get some nice massage oils. We could light a candle.
Okay. Don't steady on, sunshine.
I feel so relaxed. I feel up for the challenge of today's podcast then. What are we talking about?
So there's been this whole thing about Facebook and Cambridge Analytica and what happens to people's data. And I think it throws up a big set of questions because really what happened at Cambridge Analytica, I think, is the tip of the iceberg when it comes to what happens to our data and the way the big tech companies, the Facebooks, the Googles and others use our data. Now, the question is, should we care about it? If we do care about it, what can be done about it? And we've got three people who know a hell of a lot about this to talk about what are the answers to this, and if we do care, you know, what are some of the solutions?
It is one of the few areas where I feel like a bad progressive, because I find it quite difficult to be bothered. In a way, I think I don't care what happens to my data, and I know that's not great.
I know, but I have not been that bothered too until you work out, well, A, what's happening economically as a result of it. So some people are getting incredibly rich as a result, but it's our data that essentially they're getting rich on. Secondly, when you think about the whole fake news thing and the way that that data is used to target people, target people with a specific information. And then thirdly, where this might go in the future and what might sort of happen. So I think it's really important. It's a really important discussion.
And I am conscious that I'm saying this from a position of privilege. Maybe somebody in my position doesn't need to be that worried about their data.
And probably ignorance.
Definitely. No offense. Yeah.
I mean, me too. But I think part of it is that the stuff is free, the Google searches, the Facebook thing, or seems free. And secondly, that it's all quite hard to understand.
And we've got a brilliant comedian coming in to pitch ideas which could be potential reasons to be cheerful. You might know him from his online series for Vice, which is called Hate Thy Neighbour. He's got a new show which he's taken to the Edinburgh Festival called Vape Lord. He's really, really funny. Jamali Maddox. All right, on to our reasons to be cheerful.
What's yours?
What should mine be? Well, we've got the Easter weekend, and I'm going to see the new Wes Anderson film on Saturday night, Isle of Dogs, which I'm quite excited about. A stop motion animation. Do you enjoy a stop motion animation?
Like Wallace and Gromit?
Of course, I didn't want to bring it up.
Yeah, I thought I would instead.
I really like this.
Well, I'd like to meet Wallace one day.
That hasn't already happened.
No. Yeah. Nick Park is listening.
How about yourself? What's your reason to be cheerful?
Well, I think, as I said before, flying off to America and with my children, and we're going to the opening home game of the Boston Red Sox on Thursday, April the 5th.
Have you ever been to one of these opening games before?
I haven't been to opening day before. Opening day is quite big. It's got extra razzmatazz. My kid's first baseball game. You know why the Boston Red Sox are sort of famous, do you?
No.
So, I mean, they were best known because in 1918 they sold their star player, Babe Ruth, because the owner wanted to finance a musical, No, No, Nanette. And then they didn't win for 86 years. They didn't win the World Series for 86 years until 2004, and they came very close in lots of times. So it was known as the curse of the Bambino, the curse of Babe Ruth, basically, having sold their star player. But then in 2004 they reversed the curse. In part by beating the Yankees, their arch rivals, they have these best of seven series, and in the sort of so-called semifinals, they were 3-0 down to the Yankees and came back to win 4-3. So it was quite a sort of big moment.
So what was the bigger moment, that or the election in 97?
Oh, clearly 2004.
Reasons to be Cheerful, a podcast about ideas with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
So we're joined now by Shoshana Zuboff, who is somebody who really foresaw a lot of the developments that we're seeing today around Facebook and so on. She wrote a book called The Age of the Smart Machine in 1988, and she's got a forthcoming book called The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. Shoshana, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ed. It's a great pleasure.
Now, you coined the phrase surveillance capitalism. Can you just describe for our listeners sort of what it is, what you think motivates it, and why it's important?
Well, surveillance capitalism, obviously the word surveillance conveys a certain quality of relationship. Surveillance conveys the quality of relationship that is, you know, the one-way mirror of a unilateral seeing of others who do not see the observer. So surveillance capitalism is based on a discovery that occurred around 2001 and 2002 in Google. And that discovery was that the collateral signals that we leave when we engage in an online medium, in this particular case, Google search, we leave collateral signals. And for a long time, those collateral signals were considered to be waste, junk, and they were sometimes they weren't stored, or sometimes they were haphazardly stored in servers. There was a point at Google where they discovered that those collateral signals actually had tremendous predictive value when they were combined with Google's unique capabilities at computer science, analysis, predictive analytics, and so on. All of those disciplines that have now grown into what we call machine intelligence. And at the time, Google realized that by combining their unique analytic expertise with this cache of waste data that they had, they could create predictions about user behavior that exceeded any other form of analysis that they had. And these predictions about user behavior could be used to sell to their advertisers so that their advertisers could very specifically target ads to individuals.
What is the actual consumer loss here? So a lot of people would be quite happy that they get to search in Google and they don't need to, the point of searching, pay for it, or they get to look at their friends' photos on Facebook. What would you say to those people and that idea that they're just happy getting that for free?
You know, we have been sold on the idea that the only way we can get the connection that Facebook offers, or the only way we can get the information that Google offers, the only way we can get the goods from, you know, just hundreds and thousands of other internet companies and websites and apps, is to allow our behavior to be turned into data and used as predictions for others' commercial ends. Now, I regard that as an illegitimate proposition. But as 21st century individuals, it's become impossible for us to even participate in society without moving through the digital realm, without going through the internet and all of its ecosystems. Now, the idea that in order to access what we need for social participation, we have to give others all of this information about our behavior so that they can predict our behavior and use those predictions to sell to other people who want to influence and modify our behavior and do things to nudge us, to herd us, to tune us so that our actions most precisely conform to their commercial outcomes. What we're doing is we're creating these massive feedback loops in our society, these institutionalized feedback loops, where because other entities, enterprises, and so on are able to see our behavior and are able to predict our behavior, they're also able to intervene in our behavior at key points in order to influence us and modify our behavior. And of course, this is part of what the current scandal about Cambridge Analytica and political influence, political manipulation, politically motivated behavioral modification. These are the exact same capabilities that are simply being applied to a more complex realm that actually has profound implications, not only for our individual agency and freedom and sovereignty, but also for the very the very possibility of our democratic order and its principles and values.
What would you say to those who said this is just a more sophisticated version of the political and commercial advertising that we you know, at the moment have on TV, and you know, it may be a more targeted form of that, but it isn't qualitatively different.
Anyone who says that, I would say, dear person, come with me and read the materials and educate yourself, and you will see that there is literally no comparison between these two phases of even narrowly speaking, you know, the century-long project of commercial advertising. The key difference is that we're not talking about just a little bit of convenient targeted advertising. We're talking about global architecture of digital mediation, where vast flows of human behavior is converted into data and then is used as behavioral surplus for these processes of prediction. We're talking about an operation in which literally the greatest minds on Earth today, some of the greatest minds in computer science and data science and machine intelligence, these minds from all over the world are being employed by surveillance capitalist firms and bent to these disciplines of predicting and modifying human behavior. So that you see, you know, people with many PhDs in very complex subjects, and you read the scientific articles that they're publishing, you know, and these articles are geared to increasing the success of a targeted ad by, you know, 0.001%.
Now, you, in one of the things you wrote, quoted Eric Schmidt, the chairman and of Google and Alphabet, as saying that one of the things about the internet was that it was ungoverned space. How would you like to see it governed, or how would you like to see the problem that you identify, the profound problem you identify, be dealt with? And I know that's a complicated question.
Well, the first thing is that there is no single silver bullet, nor is this a process that, you know, is easily reduced to internet time. This is a process that takes years and decades, not days and months. So, first of all, it's a process about collective action. And my view is, you know, one of the key things the key things about where we begin here is that we begin as a group, as a public, as citizens and members of our society, getting a better understanding of exactly what this thing is, that it's illegitimate, that it's a quid pro quo that we don't have to agree to. That there are things happening that once we really understand them, we are likely to disagree with them. So we really need to get ourselves educated, because public opinion, public education is a critical piece of the puzzle.
Well, Shoshana, thank you so much for your passion, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ed. It's been a pleasure.
So we're joined now by Aral Bal Khan, a cyborg rights activist, there's a title, and Matt Lawrence, who is a senior research fellow at the IPPR. Aral, I wanted to ask you first. I often feel like a bad progressive because I kind of don't care about my data. Why should I care?
Well, I think probably it's not that you don't care about your data. It's probably that you don't entirely understand how it can be used against you, or even maybe what it is, because we keep talking about data as this generic term, and we're not even qualifying it to the extent of, are we talking about trees and rocks, or are we talking about data about people? And if we're talking about data about people, I have an example I like to give. Instead of a person, think of a small statue. If I have enough data about that statue, I can take a 3D printer and I can create a replica of that statue. So imagine what I can do if I have enough data about you. And I don't want to 3D print you.
I kind of feel like I've lived most of my life with old media, and I feel like the television are collecting viewers and different types of programs. They have different types of viewers, and then the adverts on those shows are targeted at those viewers, and the same goes for newspapers and radios and radio channels. Isn't it just a more sophisticated version of that?
It's not. It's actually completely different, because when you're looking at an ad in a traditional newspaper, the ad is not also looking at you and watching what you're doing and recording that and using that to psychoanalyze you, to create a profile of you, which it will then use to manipulate and exploit your behavior. Traditional advertising and traditional branding don't do that. What we're seeing with ad tech, which is different to advertising, ad tech is the business model of Google and Facebook. What we're seeing there is more an evolution of what we used to call spam mail in the non-digital space. And so this is about profiling and behaviorally analyzing people and then exploiting their behavior. So it's a completely different business model.
We've also got Matt Lawrence here. Matt, why don't you also engage with Jeff's question, just as a sort of starter, which is... why should we care?
Well, I think the point is, even if you don't necessarily care about your data, the companies, the platform companies that are beginning to dominate sort of the new surveillance capitalism world we're entering into, they do. And their central purpose, they are diverse in forms. You have the Amazons, you have the Googles, you have the Facebooks, but their central purpose and business model is the re-sculpting of everyday life and our relationships into one giant and expanding space for the extraction of data, for the transformation of that data into behavioral insight and the generation of profit off that. And I think that then leads to an explosion in the potential of capitalist power. It leads to an explosion of the potential for inequality. And I think it really actually fundamentally begins to imperil some of the fundamental principles of democracy. So if these companies have these vast and expanding pools of data, and that data is being used deliberately to sort of manipulate, to change behaviors, as we saw with the Cambridge Analytica thing, but on an increasing scale, then actually fundamental notions of democracy like self-determination, like self-rule, like our ability to collectively and individually order our lives in ways that we want to, rather than being pressed down upon through this ubiquitous surveillance and analysis machine, then that begins to make it matter to you, even if you don't necessarily think that the data matters in and of itself. And I think it's that point about the collective scale of this means that surveillance capitalism is a transformation in the nature of capitalism and capitalist power that is really sort of unrivaled in history.
I completely agree with Matt there. And also, your being able to say, I don't care about this, I don't care about my data, also tells me that, you know, you are probably in quite a privileged position.
Yes.
Because the people today who do care are, for example, people who happen to be gay and happen to be living in a country where maybe that's punishable by incarceration or worse. And they care that Facebook knows, because of just maybe a handful of likes, Facebook knows their sexual orientation. So they care today. And also remember that it's not just about you as well. There's an aspect of secondhand smoke here, where, for example, you might say, I'm going to use Google Mail. And that's just a decision that I've made for myself. I'm getting this service and I'm willing to give up my privacy. But you haven't just made that decision for yourself, because Google doesn't just read the emails that you write. Google also reads all the emails that everyone else sends to you. So you've also made that decision for your friends and your family and your loved ones. So this is kind of like secondhand smoke. This toxic business model, surveillance capitalism, doesn't just hurt you, it hurts the people around you as well, and society in general.
You're making me feel terrible about myself.
You should feel terrible about yourself.
But that's such not a great what I'm interface. Trying to
do. You should feel guilty.
It's such a great user experience.
But what kind of interface is it? What is the actual machine? The machine is a farming machine. It's not... So the bit that addicts you, the bit that, you know, you use that gives you value, that's the trap, right? And what the machine actually is built to do is to farm you. So it's very shiny on top and it looks great and it's wonderful, but it's built to essentially farm you like livestock.
Absolutely. And just to follow up on the sort of the privileging point, I think it sort of speaks a little bit to this delete Facebook campaign, because you can perhaps do that in sort of, you know, the advanced West, perhaps. But actually, if you look at the global South, in a lot of the world, Facebook is the internet. It provides the infrastructure, the sort of the ways in which you access the internet. And so the point here is that Facebook's not just like, oh, you know, they've done something a little bit wrong, we need to sort of say, come on, just be a better form of sort of social network. It's that the fundamental business model produces these bad outcomes, and then we need to have a systemic think around how we organize our digital infrastructure and how we govern and own our data, not just saying, oh, well, you know, Facebook, you know, you've been bad, let's maybe delete it, sort of show them what, you know, we actually need to think much more fundamentally about this digital world we're entering into. And I think actually one sort of other point just to raise in terms of why it matters is actually sort of, it's a good quote by Lenin, which I always like to use in these circumstances.
Definitely.
Exactly.
Good bit of Lenin.
Exactly. But it sort of shows how sort of capitalism has transformed with this ubiquitous surveillance model. And he sort of said, you know, looking at industrial capitalism and sort of emerging sort of state-directed industries, he said, well, in the future, all of society will become a factory. Now, that obviously didn't necessarily happen in the 20th century. There were sort of separate domains of economic life, of social life, of political life. But what you're seeing with surveillance capitalism and this sort of insatiable drive to enclose all of life in a sort of machine to extract and analyze and monetize data, you're seeing that all of life is becoming a factory. So people listening to this app will be generating data, which will be generating profits. You know, you inescapably become a market actor. You inescapably, without consent, become a sort of cog in a broader sort of machine of capital accumulation in the way we currently organize the technical systems that are the digital surveillance mechanisms. But we can do it differently. That's the key
point. And before we get onto the solutions, I think we should tease out this political aspect of it, because I can't help feeling that part of the harm here is the sort of corruption of the public square, the sense that, you know, because of the level of micro-targeting that is now possible with Facebook, we're not having one political conversation in any sense. You know, there's sort of micro-political conversations going on, many of which we won't necessarily be aware of because it's such highly targeted advertising. Is that right, Errol?
Well, to begin with, we don't have a public square anymore. We don't have a public sphere because all of our public infrastructure, our digital public infrastructure, is privatized. It's private. So Facebook and Google are not parks. They are shopping malls. And this is the heart of the problem. You know, we're looking at these shopping malls and saying, oh, you know, why is freedom of speech under threat? Well, because it's a shopping mall. Why is our privacy under threat? Because it's a shopping mall. It's not a park. And if we want to change that, we really have to start building parks and not just shopping malls, because we are funding almost exclusively shopping malls today. And that's not just private venture capital, of course, that's what it all goes into. But even EU funding is going into funding startups with this toxic business model. So that's a real problem. And yes, you know, the problem is that we mistake parks for, sorry, we mistake shopping malls for parks, and we don't have a public sphere anymore. This is the heart of the issue.
I mean, I think that's absolutely right. So I think sort of any response has to insist on sort of a reassertion of sort of publicness and public things. And I think the way to do that is to sort of mobilize around how do we concretely build up forms of democratic power? How can we actually collectively come together, whether in physical life, but also sort of in digital life? Because actually social networks and much of the sort of the things that platforms provide are things we actually want to do. We, you know, we want to be able to search, we want to be able to connect, but doing it in a way that is public and democratic. And I think the way to think about that in terms of sort of the publicness thing is to think that, well, technologies of both individual artifacts, but then sort of systems and how they interact and integrate themselves. So they're not preordained to produce certain outcomes. Their outcomes are generated by the sort of the technical, the legal, the infrastructural norms and regulations that we embed and wrap around them. And therefore, if we have a politics that demands and can construct a different type of infrastructure, then we can generate much better outcomes. Because obviously the tragedy of surveillance capitalism is that actually the generative technologies underlying it, so the ability to trace and track and analyze, actually could produce tremendously powerful public goods, you know, better transport systems, sort of help decarbonize the economy. It could, you know, ultimately ubiquitous data could mean that we could allocate goods more effectively than the price mechanism. And there are a whole host of sort of really quite emancipatory things we could do with it, but we have to sort of design and get the politics right to enact that design.
So what does a form of this look like that's more of a park than a shopping mall? What does that look like in real terms?
Well, it starts with how you design the organization itself. So we can't talk about designing ethical technologies without talking about designing ethical organizations. Matt touched upon this. You know, he said, these products that we're talking about do not exist in a vacuum. I'm paraphrasing him right now. But they exist within a greater socioeconomic system. So how do we incentivize organizations where the motive, the success criteria, isn't an exit like it is in venture capital? Because if we're talking about building ethical, sustainable businesses to create this new infrastructure, they can't be funded by venture capital. So why aren't we talking about, for example, funding them from the commons for the common good? This is one way. You know, there are other ways within the current system of capitalism that we could maybe have fairer systems based on dividends, etc. But one thing we shy away from considering at all is that, you know, these could be funded as public infrastructure, not necessarily built by governments. We could be, you know, incentivizing lots of organizations to compete to build these ethical alternatives, but in a system where we incentivize sustainable long-term businesses that can maintain control over their social missions and don't have exits and don't get sold to Google and Facebook. These are the things we should be supporting, especially in Europe, in the EU. I mean, it breaks my heart to see that we have wholesale adopted the Silicon Valley model in Europe at the European Commission, for example, and it's a complete loss of imagination. We really need to be doing things differently in Europe and in EU and supporting these ethical alternatives from the commons.
And Aral, just for the sake of listeners and for me, who are not massively well informed on this, what are the key elements of these other models that are sort of necessary? Is it people owning their own data? Is it the public sphere owning the data? What's the key things that you would be looking for?
Well, structurally, there are a couple of things. One, is it centralized or is it decentralized? Is there a corporation or an organization, for example, that's learning everything about everyone? Because we call them smart technologies, right? The question to ask is who's getting smarter about whom? If it's centralized, then there's a corporation or a government that's getting smarter about every one of us. That's not good. If it's decentralized, it means that the algorithms and the data are on our own devices. And these are still smart devices, but we're getting smarter about ourselves. Now, that's compatible with human rights and democracy. So decentralization is one aspect. Is it free and open or is it proprietary? So do I have to trust you when you say you're not doing something untoward? Or can I actually see the code that makes up these services? And can I audit it? And if I don't like what you're doing, can I, we call it forking, can I take it, make a copy of it, and build it myself, continue building it in a different direction? So decentralized, free and open, and finally, interoperable. Are these walled gardens? Or can they talk to one another? So am I locked into a single service provider, or can I actually use any service provider?
So I'm going to agree with a lot of that. I think the first point to say is we are at a real sort of crossroads. And I think that sort of the status quo, we would move on a path dependency where the rules and the norms would be defined by these sort of dominant platform monopolies. And I think that would see a radical increase in the problems we've already got, because we've got to recognize that their ambition is universal. And so really for them, they're only just getting started. So then what do we do? Well, I think reshaping sort of and repurposing sort of business and enterprise, that is sort of something that is done for the common good, that is done for sort of purposeful enterprise rather than sort of profit sort of maximization and extraction and sort of the short-termism and the destructiveness we can see with some of these platform companies is obviously sort of a key area of reform, and that speaks to how we sort of govern companies, but also how capital is owned, how capital is distributed. But then I think getting into this sort of technical issue, I think we have to look at, well, how, if we want a sort of different sort of world in which data is used and sort of put sort of social benefits, I think we need to look at sort of four questions. How is this the data generated? I mean, do we want certain objects, certain devices, certain sort of networks and relationships to generate data that can be tracked and traced? So how is that then used? Because I think this is the great tragedy, as I mentioned. Data should really be a great social good if it can be used in sort of a pro-social way rather than sort of in the current way. And I think it is worth stressing, like, you know, the great sort of bizarreness of this sort of whole situation is that Google and Facebook are two of the most sort of wealthiest companies ever created in human history. And their fundamental business model is sort of surveying us to sell data to the advertising industry. I mean, this is not really a great human mission that they're doing. So I think just saying, well, actually, can we just use this data better? And that will require re-sculpting what we actually want to see in society and sort of, I think, being tougher in terms of shaping sort of governance and sort of ownership rules. And then, of course, like, who does actually own the data? So the proprietary structure. And I think there, I mean, I'm sort of very skeptical of this idea that we're sort of individualized ownership, because I think that would actually reinforce questions of digital inequality and sort of, you know, mental health issues and the whole host of reasons why I think that is problematic. But I do think that sort of public data banks or sort of municipal, sort of, you know, can TfL own all the data generated on its networks and then people can access it sort of in an anonymous fashion, but something that sort of is something, a data commons. Can we begin to construct those, and can we use major public sector institutions as anchors? So can the BBC, for example, which has a huge digital footprint, can we begin to use that as a more effective way to sort of create a data commons for the sort of public benefit? And then the final question is, obviously, you know, these kind of companies generate an enormous amount of sort of revenue from selling sort of insight generated from our collective data and our engagement with these sort of infrastructures and these platforms. But obviously, where is the common claim to that? There's sort of wealth created by our common data. And so I think there is a question of, well, actually, if we re-sculpt, we don't necessarily want a world in which sort of the digital giants of the future are simply just, you know, mining data for behavioral insights for profit. But if we are generating value in the future from data, who has the claim on it? And I think surely it should be a common claim, given it's commonly generated.
Let me ask you, following on from that, Aral, about what you're doing in Ghent in Belgium, because presumably that is in a microcosm trying to emulate some of the solutions that you and Matt have been talking about.
So, you know, this is a great example of just what I was saying earlier, where the city of Ghent is supporting our tiny two-person and one husky not-for-profit, now based in Ireland, with building a system, a federated personal website system, really, for the common good, and they're supporting it from the commons with commons
and
money.
And just so, Ghent. Just again, for the sort of uninitiated, just explain briefly the difference between the Ghent system and everything else is what? That the data is owned by the citizens as a whole or by citizens individually?
Well, to understand, I mean, a good rule of thumb there is, if we're talking about data about rocks, then that should be owned by the commons. And Matt was talking about that at length earlier. If we're talking about data about people, that should be owned by the individuals themselves. So what we're lacking today, what we've lost to a great extent in the digital networked era, is personhood, control over our personhood. And this is what this project aims to address, by giving everyone their own place on the internet, a website. You would call it a website, right? At your own domain, but with a system that can talk to everybody else's websites. So a federated system where each website can talk to each other. And you don't need anyone in the middle, because Facebook's business model is really to be the man in the middle that knows everything. You know, on their website, they say, we connect you to the world, to each other. No, they connect you to Facebook. So we don't need that. Instead, if every one of us had our own space on the web and on the internet, then the interconnections between those individually sovereign nodes become public space. Public space in the digital sphere isn't a place you go to. It is the interconnections between individually sovereign nodes. So that's what we're building.
So what I can't quite grasp is the shiny bit of any app or Facebook or Gmail or whatever is what gets you hooked. It's the skeleton on which you're putting your photos, or you're searching within your mail or whatever use the app has.
Exactly. That's
the bit that, and they're making their money off the data. But if you take away the making the money off the data, who's paying for the nice shiny infrastructure and skeleton?
Well, I think there's actually two questions there that I would love to explore with you. But just about who's paying for it In terms of the city of Ghent for its citizens, the city of Ghent is going to be paying for it, at least for the basic amount. So let's say a certain amount of storage space, their domain names, the city of Ghent is going to pay from that from the commons. And this is a big part of the project, what's unique about it. But let's say you want, you know, a huge amount of extra space for your photos. Well, the city of Ghent is not hosting these sites, and that's a good thing. We're going to be going to independent providers, and you can switch from one to the other because it's interoperable. And if you want to have extras on top of that, then you can pay them for the extras. So we can actually start building we can have an ethical core and then build an ethical economy on top of that, as opposed to the unethical core that we have today. So that's not my primary focus in this, but that is also not incompatible with what we're doing. But the other thing you touched on, which is crucial, is these systems that we're building, these alternatives, these ethical alternatives, will live or die based on how convenient they are, how well they meet the needs of people. So nobody wakes up in the morning and says, gee, I wish I had a, you know, federated personal website I could use. No one has ever said that, no, right?
You're right.
You know, you wake up and you're right. Yeah. You know, you wake up and you say, I want to share my photo with my friend. Maybe I want to show you, you know, what I've been up to. I want to talk to you. And we need to be able to create these experiences in a beautiful way, in a delightful way. And it happens to be ethical. And that's very important. That's a lesson that sometimes the free and open source world has been very slow to grasp.
So, I mean, I think that the Ghent example is really interesting, and sort of, you know, there's a whole host of them. So you can also look at somewhere like Barcelona, which is sort of trying to sort of commons its collective data and rework sort of public procurement so that data becomes an asset that sort of citizens can use. But I mean, I think also the other thing I'd say is that speaks sort of, there's two strategies we can take with it. We can either sort of try and scale, and I don't think they're sort of opposing, I think we should really try and do both, but we can either try and scale sort of ethical alternatives from the ground up, and I think that will require a much more interventionist and frankly imaginative type of politics and type of sort of economic policy making. But at the same time, well, what do we do? I mean, Facebook and Google are not going away. So what do we do with them? Do we sort of simply try and regulate out the bads? Do we try and sort of fundamentally transform their character? And I think sort of that sort of political sort of balance and strategy of, well, what do we actually do with these giants, which are the sort of commanding heights of the contemporary economy? And crucially,
the interesting thing is, at the moment, post-Cambridge Analytica, I think there is a growing tide of anxiety. It's just it needs to find a resting place.
Yeah, exactly. And I think Cambridge Analytica is a perfect example of sort of, it could be one of those trigger moments. And I think the thing here is that actually, they have a well-developed business model with like high amounts of capital and an awful lot of data and ability to analyze it, whereas we're very much at the starting point of trying to sort of puzzle out alternatives, and obviously there's grassroots alternatives like in Ghent. But I think it's really what Cambridge Analytica shows is the real need to develop the technical and infrastructural ideas and alternatives that can actually sort of begin a different digital life world. Because I think the risk is obviously, we're talking about sort of Cambridge Analytica now, but you know what these companies are trying to do is not be companies that analyze behavioral data to sell to advertisers. In 10, 15, 20 years, sort of the platform wars, as Nick Chernichek describes it, will be about dominating AI and forms of AI trained on sort of data, digital data, which will eclipse, in many cases, the cognitive and physical capacities of humans. And that is the point at which, you know, they become...
Even Jeff looks alarmed.
Exactly. And then they become... So really, we need to sort of act quickly.
I just wanted to say, I wonder if this is a good time to focus all this energy on what I see as the biggest stumbling block in our ability to regulate these corporations, which is institutional corruption, the influence of corporate finance in public policymaking. Specifically, these very same corporations that we're trying to regulate are influencing the regulators, are influencing the policymakers through lobbying, through revolving doors, even through public-private partnerships and multi-stakeholderism. So, on the one hand, we agree, I believe, that we need to regulate them. But on the other hand, we're not being effective in regulating them because they're spending millions of euros lobbying the European Commission. They're spending millions lobbying in the US, etc. As I see it, unless we can remove the influence of this corporate finance in our regulatory processes and in our public policy making, we're going to have a very hard time regulating them. I completely agree. We need to do those two things together. We must regulate them and we must replace them with ethical alternatives. But in order to regulate them, we have to first, and maybe at the same time, combat institutional corruption.
I mean, I think that's going to be right. I think absolutely central to any response has to be sort of beware Californians bearing gifts. I think there's a real tendency to be like, oh, look at this, you know.
never accept candy from Silicon Valley is what I say.
Well, exactly. And I mean, we sort of go, oh, look at this shiny new Facebook sort of HQ in London. And we sort of get slightly distracted about that. We don't put nearly as much attention trying to sort of, invest in the everyday economy, sort of good jobs and social care, sort of gendered work, things like that. And we sort of get distracted by it. And that's partly lobbying. It's partly sort of a culture of sort of deification of California, really. That's sort of, as a sort of geopolitical idea, not really sort of a geographic location. And so I think just being skeptical about some of the claims of these companies and sort of, demanding that they actually prove their social worth rather than just sort of saying, hey, look at our shiny new this, that, or the other.
I just want to ask about an EU thing. General Data Protection Regulations, GDPR, coming into force in May. Just give us a brief take on what these mean and whether they're of any use, Errol.
Well, in a nutshell, GDPR is a very good first step. Basically, what GDPR is going to do is make it harder to retain data indefinitely, make it so that you have to have explicit permission for data that you gather. Those are really, really important. And there are other provisions in there as well. But it's a first step. It's not the end. We haven't reached the end. This is a good first step. It has things that are lacking. We don't have algorithmic transparency, for example, so we still won't know what their algorithms are actually doing. And beyond that, remember, like I was talking about institutional corruption earlier. So these companies are lobbying as we speak, especially in the context of the e-privacy directive that's being debated at the moment to try and water down, because those are going to come into effect together and affect each other, to really try and water down some of the provisions in GDPR, like explicit consent, for example. So this is an ongoing battle. And this is why I think it's very, very important that we don't become complacent in any way. The GDPR puts us light years ahead of the United States, for example, in terms of the protections that people in Europe will have. But we are still at the very beginning in terms of being able to protect the rights of European citizens as they should be protected within the digital and networked era.
So last question to both of you. We've got this thing called the Jeffocracy, but don't be put off by it. It's not like sort of the rule of Mark Zuckerberg or anything. It's Jeff as a sort of benign ruler, but it will be open source and decentralized and all of the right things.
Although if Google want to buy it, don't spoil it.
Now, let me ask both of you, Matt, why don't you go first? If you were the Minister for Technology, sort of jointly with Errol in the Jeffocracy, it's your first 100 days, Jeff calls you in, what are you going to do?
Jeffocracy is better than sort of the society of the like, which is sort of the world we live in today.
Yeah.
I think it would be something along the lines of sort of establishment of sectoral or city-based or national even sort of public data banks. So data generated on systems are anonymized and sort of in meta scale so that they can be analyzed, they can generate really useful social insights, but they don't sort of clog up around these dominant platforms. And that way sort of the value of sort of our data can yield sort of social benefits that are much more broadly and democratically shared.
Great. Errol?
Well, with all due respect to Jeff, I think I would first of all resign and then, spend I would. And I would spend my time trying to work for a future that moves beyond the Jeffocracy, because Jeff might be a benevolent king, but the fact that we have kings today and we have essentially a feudal system, our new feudal lords are the CEOs of these monopolies, is the problem. And I think we need to create a future where our only agency isn't to say to some king, please, sir, be kind, because the king today might be, but we can't predict that for the king tomorrow. So
surveillance capitalism is not just about surveillance, it's also about capitalism. And the inequalities that it's created, especially in wealth and power, and how those are being affected by surveillance, how they're being multiplied in a feedback loop. So I would resign. And I would work towards a future that's a democracy, not a Jeffocracy, so that we could have a future where we have individual sovereignty and a healthy commons.
But one of you is heading for the gulag and the other one isn't.
Matt is more diplomatic, maybe. I don't know.
That's the kind of ruler Jeff's going to turn out to be. Aral and Matt, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Thank you so much for having us.
My head's exploding.
It is a really complicated one to wrap your head around, isn't it? And I do accept that point, that the reason I'm not bothered about it is because I talk from a position of privilege. I think it's obviously something that can affect you more if your circumstances are quite different to mine. But even through talking great length, as we just did, I can see that the general data protection regulations from the EU are a reason to be cheerful. But what I don't see this week is anything really that looks like a clear solution.
We need to be talking about this because, look, government and people, I think, have been slightly asleep on this. The shininess of the apps and the offering and the service has blinded us to what's actually going on. And I do think that the accumulation of all this information in private hands is something which is somewhat problematic now, as Cambridge Analytica, the Russian ads, you know, in the presidential election, fake news, all of that shows. But it could get worse, I think. And therefore, the question is, what should be done? You clearly need protections around data, and obviously this GDPR is a start. I think these companies should stop being able to acquire all of this extra power. So just to give you sort of an example, Facebook owns Instagram, WhatsApp, Oculus, and Masquerade, which I think is some competitor with Snapchat. I mean, why does it need to buy up all these other things? And why should it be allowed to have that kind of huge kind of a concentration of power? I mean, I think all concentrations of power of that kind are problematic.
But that's become the Silicon Valley business model. Let's start a company and we're not figuring out how to make this company profitable. We're figuring out how do we get bought by Facebook or Google.
Yeah, exactly. So secondly, we've got to look at how we start to limit the power of these companies. And then thirdly, longer term, I think we've got to think about, you know, who should have ownership of this data? Where does it lie? And how do we sort of protect the public good? Because the public good, we don't want to stop people having kind of, you know, being able to do searches that are efficient. And we don't want to stop people communicating with each other. And in fact, you know, there's lots of great things about the internet, but we've got to make sure we protect the public good of the internet and the positive aspects of it from the more dangerous accumulations of private power.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
If you've got thoughts about data or other things you've heard on the podcast, please do email us reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com, or you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at cheerfulpodcast, or on Facebook, facebook.com/reasons-to-be-cheerful-podcast. And we've had some great emails this week. One here from Stephen Wynne Davis. Hello, Jeff and Ed. I wanted to thank you both for mentioning the Rye and Battle Observer article in your most recent podcast, Housing First, Tackling Britain's Homelessness Crisis, in which Amber Rudd calls 3 homeless deaths in Hastings between Christmas and New Year a tragedy. I'm the reporter behind the article. I've been researching the topic for the past few months and looking at just how deep the crisis has become. Via figures provided to me by the Office for National Statistics, I found there was a record high number of people sleeping rough in Hastings during the autumn of 2017. As a result of our investigation, myself and my colleagues at the Hastings Observer launched a campaign called Hope for the Homeless in February, Our mission is to halt the rise of rough sleeping in the town. And to do this, we're working with a number of different charities and organisations in the town that work with and support the homeless community. However, like any campaign, we need support. So we'd be really thankful if you could encourage people to join us. The website is here and it'll be on our Facebook page, or you can visit the Hastings Observer Facebook page. So, Stephen, thank you for emailing in. He says, I'm a big fan of the podcast and thank you for drawing attention to this important issue.
This comes from Artan, who says, it's not often I find cheer on the tube. However, this morning, whilst listening to your podcast, I looked up to see Ed standing in the carriage, very generously making way for someone else to take an empty seat.
That sounds like me.
What's your criteria? What you're looking for? Is it the elderly, the pregnant?
Yeah, elderly, pregnant, or looking like they want a seat.
If you see me on the tube, would you offer up
have,
a seat?
I think I have the sort of baseline of sort of seat giving up sort of tendency, but with an extra dollop of politician paranoia that I'm going to be sort of, you know, sitting there enjoying my seat while some poor person who sort of broke their leg or something might be wanting a seat.
Thinking how much a cheerful coincidence this was, says Artan, who of course was listening to the podcast, I took out my earphones to go tell him until I noticed his son was with him. I may look a bit weird.
But he would be very welcome to come up to me.
And that goes for anybody who sees Ed on any form of public transport.
Indeed, yeah.
Okay. And this one comes from Giles, who says, David and Jeff. Now, we're not sure which David he's mistaking you
this
for
isn't
here.
This is your fourth podcast that you're doing privately with my brother, is it?
Well, I didn't know if you meant your brother or if you met David Cameron.
Oh, maybe that's true, yeah. Actually.
He says, I'm a newish listener of your pod, which I came to through the Talking Politics podcast and the Limehouse podcast. I live in Melbourne, and we used to have a make-your-own sandwich chain here.
I think
here.
This trend is not my friend, is
unfortunately,
it?
It's no longer around.
I think we've now established, one, there have been MYO sandwich shops. Two, they haven't done very well. Three, there are very few left.
At least thanks, Giles, for letting us know you're there and letting us know that it has been attempted down under.
I haven't lost faith.
Email us reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Follow us on Twitter at Cheerful Podcast or search for our Facebook page, Reasons to be Cheerful Podcast.
And here to pitch ideas which could be potential reasons to be cheerful, we're joined by comedian Jamali Maddox. Hello.
Hey, I'm all right. What's up? Nice to meet you.
Will you tell us about Hate Thy Neighbour? This has been a big success for you.
Yeah. What do you know about it?
Well, you know, for people who haven't seen
what the show is.
What is
that?
It? Yeah.
Appeals to Jeff because he probably does hate his neighbour.
Yeah.
I like the ones on either side. It's just a bit further out than that.
Right. It is always the weird politics because you've got to get along with the next door neighbours unless it's something massive. But the other ones you can hold grudges against.
Exactly, yeah. You want to be close enough to your neighbours that if you go away and forget to cancel the milk, they'll happily go and pick it up for you and check that you haven't been burgled. But I don't think you want to be getting into an intimate relationship with them. If it goes wrong... Yeah. Then, you know,
you're a closed off dude.
I am a closed off dude. You've worked that out already.
I bet they're lovely people, but it's you.
No, they are lovely people. Yeah, I'm the problem.
You just want to sit in your act with Ed Miliband.
Exactly. Yeah.
Maybe we should just like issue an invitation to them. Easter Monday, if you're listening to the podcast and you're one of Jeff's neighbours.
Come down.
I bought him some hot cross buns. There might be a few left. Ring the bell and come round.
You're always welcome.
You're always welcome anytime.
Jeff's got open house policy.
Yeah, open house. Yeah.
But I do wonder if any of the neighbours have seen you coming in and out of my house and they think, what the hell is going on?
It would look weird. Yeah. If it was me, I'd be writing notes. Yeah. Just checking. You know what I'm saying? It's like, what's that Miliband? Just coming around his house every week.
I looked out the window after he left last week and he was posing for selfies with the traffic wardens.
It was in order to try and avoid getting a parking ticket.
Yeah.
Sorry, back to Hate Thy Neighbour.
Yeah, sorry. Basically, it's a show. It was on Vice, and I went around the world and I spoke to fascists and sort of hate groups, like neo-Nazi groups in America. I spoke to fascist groups in Ukraine, Israel, Sweden. And I'd done stand-up in between it. And in the second episode, I went across America and I just spoke to people with controversial ideas, not necessarily hate groups, but people who are like sort of really staunch anti-abortionists. We went to one where it was like a brat camp where people send their kids to a prison for 72 hours for discipline.
Oh my God.
I was just interested in why.
Yeah.
Like, why do you think? Because the thing is like, even though I don't excuse their beliefs, because their beliefs are disgusting a lot of times, especially the fascists and all that stuff. But you forget that they're people that have had an experience.
Yeah.
and you think, okay, but what's made you this? Because that's so extreme with politics, so sort of polarized.
Yeah.
Is that everyone talks about things in the most extreme nature. So I want to actually, well, I want to meet the real fascists, because everyone says that. I mean, you see on Twitter a lot, everyone's like, you're a Nazi. I was like, they're not Nazis. They're c***s, but they're not Nazis. Do you know what I'm saying?
Right.
There's a big, you know, there's a very big difference, you know, and that's a real, so I want to speak to those people.
But do you feel that having spoken to those people, it might have made them rethink?
No.
Right.
No. I mean, because I'm not deluded with entertainment. Like, I think that the people who watch it and like it probably aren't racist.
Yeah.
And the people who don't like it, you know, like those people I spoke to would still be racist. I don't think there's anything wrong with having some type of dialogue, but then there needs to be a point where you go, look, you know, we can't debate ridiculousness. Even having a conversation about did the Jews die in the Holocaust is ridiculous.
Yeah.
And are we going to have this conversation? Do you know what I'm saying?
No, yeah, I do. Just, yeah, yeah. It sort ridiculous. Of legitimizes.
Yeah, and you're like, I'm not doing this. You know what I'm saying? And so, yeah, I'm done with that. But yeah, I've done that for a long time.
So, Jamali, you brought some ideas which could be potential reasons to be cheerful. What's your first one?
All right. So these are things that we could implement to make a better world.
Yes.
I'm guessing, yeah?
Yeah.
All right. This is a nice one, because I got some ones that I think just came from anger. And I was just sitting there like, this is what I want to see in the world. I think that the workday shouldn't be 9 to 5. It should be 11 to 4.
So a much shorter. That's good. I think shorter working is quite a good idea.
Didn't they trial this in a few companies in Sweden?
Yeah, they you know, the Swedes didn't do it right. Listen, the British public.
I don't think it was proved to be bad in Sweden.
No, I don't know that it was proved to be quite as effective as they thought it was going to be.
Oh, you're such a policy wonk. You're such a policy nerd, you.
Yeah. You're going deep in these policies.
No, I'm all for working less.
You're all for starting work at 11 o'clock.
Absolutely, yeah.
You think about it, you go to work. I mean, I haven't been to work for a long time, but when I did go to work for that week, right?
Yeah.
I've only had two jobs. When I did go to work for that week, 9 o'clock, you're messing around for a bit. You know, you're messing around. You know, exactly, going straight to work. You're not doing Labour Party business. You're messing around for a little bit, checking emails.
Yeah.
You know, get there 11 o'clock, and then you start the day. You check out.
Well, they
emails.
Did say this about Swedish thing, that people were worked more intensively. And also, if I can say about Jeff and I went on a mini break to Vienna a few weeks back, and
nice.
Professional mini break. And the night before, Jeff said, "What breakfast? What time should we meet?" And I said, "Well, what time do you want?" He's like, 9 perhaps. And then I got a text, which I kind of predicted, at about 8:30, saying, how would you feel about 9:15? So, you know, Jeff's not a morning, but I'm not a morning person.
What time did you wake up?
About 7:30.
Well, that's a morning person.
Yeah, that is a morning
that's
person.
That's mad.
Really?
Yeah. I thought you were the man of leisure. I thought you'd be waking up I thought you'd be waking up at 10:30.
What time do you wake up?
About 11?
Oh, really?
12?
What time do you get to bed?
About 2.
Okay.
Because I think I get back from a gig at like 12.
Yeah, so. I do too as well, actually.
There you go.
But we had Dan Pink on the show who talked about natural rhythms.
Yes, yeah, so we shouldn't be judgmental about this.
No.
You've obviously got natural rhythms, which is you go to bed later.
Yeah.
What time do you go to bed?
Midnight,
damn. Yeah.
Not sure I even believe that, because sometimes he's sending emails at the podcast at 1:45 in the
well,
morning.
Well, exactly. Okay, maybe
you're up late. We know your lifestyle.
Yeah, exactly. Partying.
Right, 11 to 4. I'm very into that.
Yeah.
So I think I should mind going to politics, mate.
You should. I'll vote for you.
Yeah, thank you. I'll vote for you.
You wouldn't like the hours.
No, I wouldn't know that. I think the hours would be wrong.
What else do you have?
I've got banning kids from pubs.
But what age are you allowed in pubs?
I've seen people bring their babies to pubs.
I think if a pub does food, then you can take your kids.
Yeah, but no loopholes.
So you would like to see a return to the days where divorced dads would go to the pub on a weekend and leave the kids sitting outside with a glass of lemonade.
Yep, and I think we should try and bring back smoking in the pubs to try and discourage people bringing their babies.
So far.
David Cameron, of course, famously left his child in the pub.
Yeah.
Yes.
How are the kids ruining the pub?
They're noisy. They're just being kids.
Well, people are noisy in pubs.
Yeah, I know, but I can't swear now in the pub because someone brought their baby Oliver to the pub.
Oh, so I agree with that.
Or Niles. Yeah. Or the baby Niles is in the pub.
Niles has to be a broad-minded baby if he's in the pub,
exactly.
I think, in the first place.
Yeah.
I'm not sure
And he's got to have better banter.
Yeah.
He's got to have better convo. I don't want to hear about your dumb shows, mate.
I don't think we want to be banning Niles from the pub.
No, we want to ban him, mate.
You think so?
Yeah, we should ban him.
Don't you think pubs have been tremendously improved, though, since when... you were younger?
I mean, it's nice knowing going into a pub I'm not going to get glassed, but it kind of ruins the surprise a little bit. You know, it's a bit of danger when you used to go to the pub, no?
So where do we stand on this, banning kids in pubs then?
I'm not so sure.
Right. And did you have one more idea?
Yes. I think TV should come with every channel.
So
with a TV license,
yep,
that money should be used. So just for BBC, I think we should be able... So on the TV only comes with the basic channels. I think it should come with every channel.
So you think our TV license should make sure you get Challenge TV with the old repeats of Bullseye and the E exclamation mark channel?
Yeah, I don't think you just
get
BBC. I think you should get every, I think it should be...
Hang on, don't
channel.
You get... Doesn't digital TV get you...
It gets you more channels, but not every channel. I can't watch Cheaters.
What's that?
You haven't seen Cheaters? No. Yo, you go to Cheaters, bro. What's that? Cheaters is an old 2000s show where basically you go and say, listen, I think my wife or my partner's cheating on me. And then they send investigators to go find out.
Oh my God.
And then
they... What channel is it on?
It's on Reality. So you don't get, see, because you didn't know. You only got
you
the basic channels.
Right?
You don't get reality. So you had the basic channels and you're missing out. Yeah, that's like my... Because especially when you speak to Nazis for 2 years, you kind of have to unwind.
True.
With something a little bit more silly.
You need Cheaters.
Yeah, you need Cheaters.
But what about the impact on the BBC if they were giving it to the channel that shows Cheaters? I'm not sure which one
BBC
it is.
BBC have to say, I don't know.
So then it'd be less money for David Attenborough.
I mean, Attenborough's had enough money. I love Attenborough, but he's had enough now. I can't wait, Attenborough. We get it, you know? We've had enough.
We've seen enough
We've
animals.
Seen enough whales. Like, you're not telling me nothing new about whales, Attenborough.
Jeff and I won this award recently, and I had David Attenborough won an award, and I had a selfie with David Attenborough. But Jeff's really offended, which is basically a common running theme, but I didn't introduce him to David Attenborough.
You didn't introduce... Did you know him before?
David Attenborough,
yeah.
Jeff.
Yeah,
David
Attenborough, yeah. You know him before?
Yeah.
You know people in high places, isn't it? You're a real player.
When I was sitting at the next table, he went over to talk to David Attenborough at the next table 2 hours. Now, presumably, the conversation went, David Attenborough says in his marvellous voice, oh, so you're here for the podcast. That would have been a perfect opportunity for Ed to say, yeah, I'm here with my co-host. Jeff, come and say hello to David Attenborough.
I know, I do feel guilty.
Who wouldn't want to meet David Attenborough?
I do feel guilty about it, actually.
Is he trying to make this only a work relationship and you don't want to bring him into your personal life? The crazy parties with David Attenborough and stuff.
I think it was just... I was just starstruck.
Yeah, that's what he says. He goes bed at 12. Yeah, him and Attenborough up, mate. Spending that BBC money. You know how they're getting, Dan. I've heard about the Miller Band. That's what they call him. The Miller Band.
No, I was...
I think they call him our Miller Band.
Our Miller Band.
Jamali, your Edinburgh show, does it have a name yet?
Yeah, it's called Vape Lord. Yeah.
That's a good title.
It's a bit of vape talk. You wouldn't understand.
I don't understand.
Yeah, no,
it's gone over my head.
Yeah. So you're going to be in Edinburgh and then on tour.
We'll see you in Edinburgh.
Yeah, I'll come down.
Lovely to see you.
Thank you very much.
Cheers.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
We're going to be apart for 15 days.
Is that the longest we've ever been apart
since we started
the podcast?
I mean, I'll have your mother-in-law, hopefully, to sort of fill some of the gap in Chicago.
She certainly fills a gap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's going to be doing, hopefully, a little bit of babysitting.
Is that right?
Yes.
You've employed her for childminding.
Yeah, I don't know about employed. She volunteered.
Well, I'm sure your boys...
Well,
will.
I'm with David Axelrod doing an event in Chicago. She's going to be doing some babysitting, hopefully.
They'll have a great time, your lads, with Lynn Barron going around Chicago, seeing the fat shallots.
I'll send you a postcard. Well, people don't do postcards anymore, do they?
No, you could send me a selfie.
Yeah. Should we thank our guests?
We should, yes.
They're brilliant guests this week. Shoshana Zuboff, Aral Balkan and Matt Lawrence.
And comedian Jamali Maddox. Emma Corsham produced our podcast with research and backup from Alex Feisbreist and Lindsay Todd. Gail Lofthouse is our announcer. James Deacon made our idents. Ed Seed composed the music and Emily Power made our artwork.
Brilliantly done.
She did a good job of the artwork, didn't she?
Well, no, I meant your credit. They roll off the tongue.
Thank you very much. So when you're back from your jollies, we'll be in Bristol.
Correct.
We've got a live show in Bristol on Friday the 13th. We'd love you to come along. Go to bit.ly/cheerfulbristol to get your tickets, or you can find a link in the notes to this week's programme.
He's been the Easter Bunny.
He's got hot cross buns.
And these have been
Reasons to be Cheerful.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.